And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson.
For more than five decades, Edgewater Health has provided physical and behavioral health care services in Northwest Indiana. In observance of Mental Health Awareness Month, we're joined now by LaTanya Woodson, the Director of Community Health, as well as Dr. Karen Bishop Morris, the Chief Development Officer, to share details of the big event, as well as give a glimpse of all of the services and free programs offered. Dr. Bishop Morris and LaTanya, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Edgewater Health has been a provider of primary and behavioral care services in the region for 50 years now, dating back to the administration of Gary Mayor Richard Gordon Hatcher. Take a moment to highlight some of the milestones of Edgewater Health.
Such a great question, Dee. And again, thank you for having us on. You know, it's been 50 years of healthcare excellence, 50 years of serving the community, based in Gary, as you know. But in those 50 years, the footprint has expanded dramatically. Many folks don't realize that Edgewater actually provides services in 10 locations across Northwest Indiana. Our most recent facility opened in Merrillville with Dr. Njikubi in the fall of 2023. We also provide services and have an office with Dr. McCullough in Cedar Lake, as well as other primary care facilities, one at our main campus in Gary off 6th Avenue and also in Griffith. So I think the expansion of the geographic footprint is a big one, but there have also been some notable firsts. So for instance, our CEO, Dr. Demita Johnson Woods, has served the organization as CEO for 28 years. So that's an incredible milestone in and of itself.
Wow.
But she is still the only African-American female CEO of a community behavioral health center in the state of Indiana, which is pretty incredible given our 50-year history. I would just point to another first, and that being in 2015, Edgewater established the first rapid access center, which is a crisis stabilization center in the state of Indiana. And so even though other centers are moving to this model and recognizing the importance of crisis stabilization, Edgewater was the first to really roll out coordinated care between our facility, emergency services, area hospitals, and law enforcement to provide more immediate, compassionate care. So rather than sending folks in the middle of a crisis to the local lockup or overcrowding emergency rooms where they probably wouldn't get the specialized attention that they need, they can come to our rapid access center, be received, assessed, triaged, and then receive either longer-term care or referrals. So, yeah, we're pretty excited about all of the things for the last 50 years.
Now, Dr. Bishop Morris, I read somewhere that you shared that Edgewater Health, the now full service clinic, has evolved from an institution primarily focused on mental health to one that promotes and supports what you refer to as whole person care. And one of the things that caught my eye as I was preparing for our conversation today was Edgewater Health's tagline, for the whole life. Edgewater Health customizes treatment for each patient to ensure the best outcome. So talk about the services offered at Edgewater Health Primary and Behavioral Healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to bring LaTanya in on this too. But just to make a connection between the history of Edgewater and our 50th anniversary event on Saturday, June 1st, one of our honorees is Dr. Okechi Ndozi-Wabara, who is the former chief medical officer for Edgewater Health. This is a posthumous recognition. Sadly, we lost Dr. Wabara during the COVID pandemic. But in 2016, Dr. Wabara ushered in primary care into the Edgewater brand. So from 1974 until 2016, firmly rooted in our DNA was behavioral health care. And so, sure, that is our flagship. But beginning in 2016, it was really Dr. Wabara who said, you know, if you're suffering from mental health issues, chances are you're probably neglecting some physical health issues and vice versa. And so I think that was really sort of the exclamation point on the need to provide integrated behavioral health and primary care services. So since that time, the evolution has been amazing. LaTanya and her team have really built out the brand to offer a full roster and array of free programming to the community. And I'll let her speak to some of those services. So thank you for that. And I want to place emphasis on when you indicated the whole person. And Dr. Wood's vision extended to educating the community and addressing the stigma to mental health. So as you indicated, May is Mental Health Awareness, and we're doing something huge today at Edgewater Health. As you know, Dee, every third Thursday of each month, we have the Mind, Body, and Spirit Wellness Program. And what that program is, it's a year-long program that's for our clients, our patients, our residents, our staff, and the community at large. And it helps us to discover our personal journey to overall wellness. So what we do is we internally, external leaders, you know, providers, experts in their field, they come here and they talk about various things that occur just in everyday living. Because, you know, the vulnerable population, as you know, there's an increase in obesity, there's an increase in stress, depression, chronic illness, most often due to unhealthy lifestyles and unaddressed trauma. So what we do is we address those topics in an open conversation, in an open presentation where you get a chance to meet our staff, you get a chance to meet our therapists, you get a chance to meet our physicians and ask those questions that you would like to ask.
If I could just piggyback on that, Dee, in addition to the Mind, Body, Spirit series that LaTanya spearheaded, which has been so successful and is now in its second year, there's also an array of other services, including a grocery locker program. So this provides groceries twice a week to individuals in our community who may be experiencing food insecurity. There are programs that are sort of age specific. So there's a program called Chat and Chew that targets issues related to seniors in our Cedar Lake community, issues such as disease prevention and management, as well as overall health and wellness. So just a number of free programs. I encourage folks to go to the website, edgewaterhealth.org, to learn more about all of the amazing work that Edgewater is doing in the community around mind, body, and spirit.
I'm so glad that you guys shared information regarding all of the free programs that are available. A lot of the programs in which you partner with other local organizations, including the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. Dr. Bishop Morris and LaTanya, so I wanted to have the opportunity to speak with the two of you in observance of Mental Health Awareness Month. As you've shared, Edgewater Health offers a wealth of health services, including mental health services, as well as early intervention and prevention, serving patients of all ages. Dr. Bishop Morris, earlier in our conversation, you shared a bit about the Rapid Access Center and how it helps decrease the strain placed on other community institutions. And as you were speaking, I was reminded of a publication I read earlier about the intersection of mental health crisis and the criminal justice system. In that report, it detailed that oftentimes law enforcement is left to handle mental health cases but are ill-equipped. And it went on to share that someone in crisis that may be incarcerated for any length of time, that by the time the individual returns to society, even if the detainment is 1 day, 1 week, 1 year, or any number of years, that isolation, that lack of proper mental health care treatment can in some ways contribute to the deterioration or decline in mental well-being. Is that why the Rapid Access Center model is necessary to create a more seamless system?
Absolutely. You nailed it. You're absolutely right. It takes the pressure off of, again, the hospital. It takes the pressure off of law enforcement and the criminal justice system. But it's most importantly a more compassionate response and more compassionate care for the individual and the families that are experiencing the crisis. They can actually receive, again, the specialized treatment and attention that they need, rather than just becoming a number and part of a system that usually exacerbates whatever conditions they're experiencing. And, you know, I'd like to just add one thing. So Edgewater obviously has been in the crisis stabilization business since 2015 in a very serious way with that facility, with other plans to expand in the near future. But I also want to talk about how we're meeting that need in an earlier way, injecting ourselves or intervening in this sort of continuum and life cycle
that often leads to this kind of breakdown, if you will, early on. So we have a new initiative called My Brother's Keeper, and it's technically My Brother's Keeper, Lake County, Indiana. Mm-hmm. It is part of the National MBK Alliance that is sponsored by the Obama Foundation. In 2014, some will remember that President Obama issued a national call to communities to do something to intervene and remove barriers for boys and young men of color in the country. And so Edgewater, to fast forward, last fall was designated as the community backbone organization for My Brother's Keeper in Lake County, Indiana. This effort is chaired by Bernard Carter, to get to your point, who's the Lake County prosecutor and our chair and champion of MBK. And that work, in a nutshell, is Edgewater strengthening a community ecosystem that consists of law enforcement, government agencies, K through 12, higher education, community organizations, employers, the whole gamut. But at the center of that are youth and families. And so again, because of our expertise, if you will, in integrated healthcare, we play a very vital role in, and we'll be playing an even bigger role in helping these families identify the needs they have around whole person care. And not recreating the wheel. We're not building new mentoring programs or telling people, you know, where to go to be seen for their mental health or primary care services. We're just strengthening the spokes of a wheel that already exists. And so, to your point, this is how we're really seeing and, again, addressing the whole continuum of care for patients in the community. Again, Gary as a priority, but the entire Lake County is really our playground, so to speak. So I thank you for that question.
Thank you for sharing that. Again, Edgewater Health is a primary and behavioral health care system with 10 locations across the region. How can we find out more information on locations as well as how to make an appointment for our physical and our mental health care needs?
844-4-EDGEWATER-HEALTH.
LaTanya Woodson is the Director of Community Health Education, and Dr. Karen Bishop Morris is the Chief Development Officer with Edgewater Health. Thanks to both of you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you.
And thank you. This was awesome. And thank you, Dee.
And welcome back to Regionally Speaking.
Teen development is a cluster of seeming contradictions. On the one hand, adolescents are capable of remarkable feats, including taking complex classes, working part-time jobs, and beginning to map out their futures. Yet despite their growing independence, they still require a strong network of adults to guide them through this transformative phase of life. As teens navigate friendships, identify formation, and have increasing responsibilities, they also encounter stressors that can feel overwhelming. Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman joins us now and shares this is especially true today as data shows concerning rates of anxiety, depression, and stress among young people. Tammy, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So Tammy, this month's column, Understanding and Supporting Teen Well-Being in All Its Complexity, it really hits home for a lot of Hoosier parents and caregivers, including parents like myself right here in the region. And there's a lot to unpack as we dive into it, from helping our youth navigate making difficult decisions about their future, to even counseling and encouraging them through their friendships and their romantic relationships, just to name a few. As the 2024-2025 academic year wraps up over the course of the next few weeks, share a bit more about why you say, quote, teen development is a cluster of seeming contradictions.
Yeah, thank you for that great question. You know, on the one hand, we see our teens, you know, they're taking all these really complex classes, sometimes classes that even as adults we have long forgotten or maybe never took in the first place, you know, calculus and physics and all these complex classes. They may be working part-time jobs. They're talking about great opportunities that are ahead of them and maybe exploring careers again that are really complex, which makes us think that they're almost adults, right? And so at the same time, they're getting that growing independence, and yet they still need that network of strong adults to guide them. So on the one hand, their sophistication of thinking and experiences are growing and maturing quickly. On the other hand, we can't lose sight of the fact that they are still developing youth that we need to help support. Teens were never intended to, grow themselves or to guide themselves through all of adolescence. And it's important that we understand all that they're dealing with so that we can be helpful.
Tammy, you dedicate a section in your column to share how your organization, Indiana Youth Institute's Kids Count Data Book, provides valuable insight into how teens are faring academically, emotionally, and socially. How can parents and caregivers be more empathetic, more understanding of the complexities teens face?
Again, I think it starts with understanding, that right now there are some things that are different. There are more kids that have told us that they are struggling with stress, anxiety, and or depression. So in fact, most recently, 30% of Indiana students in grades 7 through 12 told us that they were feeling so sad or hopeless for at least 2 consecutive weeks that they stopped engaging in their usual activities. And that's, that's a third of our kids, just right at a third of our kids. So that's something that we need to pay attention to, because that's when we know something's not right. Now, there are ups and downs for teens, where if they have a bad day here or there, if they display a lot of anger, or maybe they break out in tears, those little hiccups along the way are very normal for teens. When it becomes that pattern of so sad and hopeless for 2 or more consecutive weeks, that's when we need to be concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should note, as May recognizes Mental Health Awareness Month, as you shared in your column and in that Kids Count data book about the 1/3 of our youth facing feelings of sadness and or loneliness, right here in the region, 33% of youth had those feelings of sadness and or hopelessness for 2 or more weeks in 2024, compared to 1/3 that you've shared statewide. Tammy, I want to ask you, what role does social media play in teen mental well-being?
Well, we do know that there's been an increase in teen distress, and that smartphones and social media are contributing to that. And so that constant connectivity, that online comparison, and the loss at the same time, you have both of those things, at the same time you're losing the face-to-face interactions, all can be negative for teens. So really thinking about, how do we limit? We know we're not going to remove screen time, but what's a reasonable amount? How much is needed and necessary and normal? But where do we need to set boundaries around that technology use so that we can protect our teens' mental health? We know that, for example, people don't usually post on social media when they had a fight with their friends or when they didn't make the team that they were hoping to. They post happy things that seems like, that everybody else, everything's going great for. And that can be a stressor for kids who are dealing with some of those very normal, very, very normal teen encounters that actually some of those stressful teen encounters aren't all bad.
Tammy, another point you lay out in your latest column, understanding and supporting teen well-being in all its complexity. This is one I found quite interesting. You note that not all stress is harmful or hurtful. Spend a minute or so unpacking that a bit more for our listening audience.
Yes. So we know that emotional discomfort is actually a natural part of adolescence and learning to navigate stress, learning to navigate those ups and downs, those frustrations when maybe you've had a disagreement with a good friend, maybe you were testing a new romantic relationship and it fell apart. Maybe you're angry at someone or yourself because you didn't do as well on a test as you thought you might. Those are all important navigation tasks that kids need to learn how to deal with. So we're not looking for removal of stress. In fact, helping them navigate those uncomfortable emotional moments is part of adolescence. So we need to really lean in and talk to kids about, what do you do when you get angry? What do you do when you're disappointed? What do you do when your feelings are hurt? And help them develop those skills that will serve them better in the long run than trying to keep any stress away from them.
And I should attribute the quote that not all stress is harmful to Dr. Lisa Damore, a leading expert that I understand Indiana Youth Institute will be collaborating with. Can you share a bit more about Dr. Damore and what you have planned for Hoosier Parents, Caregivers, and youth serving organizations coming up?
Yes, Dr. Lisa Damore is one of our country's leading experts on teen well-being and particularly mental health. And we are very excited that we have an event coming up on May 6th where she is going to be the keynote speaker. And she's going to be talking about how do we help teens grow up with a feeling of well-being. And so it is a virtual event. So anyone who is interested in attending can sign up and register even the morning of because it's a virtual event. So you can go to IYI.org and all the information is there. But we are super excited that we have the opportunity to learn from and listen to someone with such a depth of experience and knowledge.
Tammy, before I let you go, I just have to ask you to share, because a lot of parents and caregivers alike find themselves helpless when it comes to providing the best support for our teens. How can we support our Hoosier teens? What does that even look like?
Well, there's a lot of ways. Again, part of it is that we can be present, right? So we need to be present. Let them talk about whatever they are and whatever they're experiencing. So it's listening without that judgment, which can be harder than it may sound, modeling healthy coping skills, and then being that consistent presence. And that means kids like to be in predictable settings. They like to know what's coming up, what's expected of them. They like to know that somebody cares enough to lean in and guide them. So again, it's not as hard as it may sound. It's listening without judgment, modeling healthy coping skills, and being that consistent, caring presence. That will go a long way. It may not fix everything, but it'll certainly go a long way to letting kids know that there is a network out there that is supportive of them, that knows that adolescence is not an easy time, and yet many, many people navigate it and come out on the other side. So each teen has a unique experience, but with the right support network, they can certainly navigate these critical years.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of Indiana Youth Institute. Tammy, if anyone would like more information about your organization, as well as information on how to access that virtual session, how can they do so?
They can find it all at their fingertips at IYI.org.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. Purdue University Northwest will enroll students in its first Master of Social Work cohort in fall 2025. Purdue Northwest has been building up several of its graduate level programs over the past couple of academic years and solidifying an interdisciplinary array of learning and research opportunities that are focused on mental health outcomes and needs for our local communities. This academic year marks the first year for cohorts in the master's and doctoral programs in psychology. Joining us now to share more about the program is Dr. Sharia Bhandari, the director of the MSW program and a professor of social work at PMW. Dr. Bhandari, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Bhandari, as I shared in my opening, you are the director of the MSW program. You are a professor of social work at Purdue University, and you are a highly respected leader in social work education. And you're with us here today again to share more about the exciting news that the institution is currently recruiting students for the Master of Social Work program. Now, before we talk more about the program, share with the listening audience what led you to be named the director of the Master of Social Work program.
Yeah, so our Master's of Social Work program has been in the making for a few years now. As you know, we are located in the Northwest Indiana region, and we just don't serve students in Northwest Indiana, but the larger Chicagoland region. And we are in such a, you would say, a lack of mental health services, de-addiction services, so to speak, a mental health desert, that we really need a program that is affordable for students to be trained as professionals to work in our communities. And that is why, Purdue decided to launch this program. And we've been working very hard for the past 2 to 4 years in trying to start this program in this region.
I shared in the opening that the College of Humanities, Education, and Social Sciences is expected to enroll its first cohort in fall 2025. I would love for you to tell us more about the MSW curriculum and how the program will bring students new insight into disparities throughout our communities, as well as how social workers can be agents of change for the common good.
Absolutely. So our program will train students to work at all levels. One of the unique things about social work is that we train students to not just work with individuals and families, but we go beyond that, which is individuals, groups, families, organizations, and communities. So our students, the specialization of our program is advanced generalist. So while we'll have a good number of clinical courses focused on mental health, substance abuse, we will also have in our curriculum an equal number of courses focused on policy development, agency administration. And so when a student graduates from the Master's of Social Work program at Purdue University Northwest, they will be equipped to work in any setting and not just limited to a school or a hospital, but could work in the government, could work with an advocacy agency, so on and so forth. And that was done intentionally. The curriculum has been structured in this way that the student, you know, when they graduate, will have all the knowledge, skills that they need to work in a variety of settings and address the disparities in the region.
Dr. Mandari, you shared at the start of our conversation that PNW has been building up several of its graduate-level programs over the past couple of academic years and solidifying an interdisciplinary array of learning and research opportunities that are focused on mental health outcomes and needs for our local communities. And I want to park on something that you just shared. So, and I think you said it, but I want to be sure that our listening audience hears this. So I want to ask you, will this new MSW program help meet the regional need for the social worker?
Yes, absolutely. And it will absolutely help meet the needs of, you know, social work in the region. And like you said, we are trying to make this as a hub of a variety of programs that students can choose from. So we already have a long-standing couples and family therapy program that has been around for almost 30 years. We newly launched our PsyD program this past fall, and then our mental health counseling program has also been around for some time. And the newly launched Master's of Social Work program is just, you know, the newer program that we are adding on to absolutely meet the needs of, you know, the social workers in the region. As most of our graduates live in our region, they want to live in our community. And so that is why there is a huge need of offering affordable graduate level education in a variety of disciplines, including social work.
As you were talking, and I'm going to go off script for a moment, because I want to talk more about social service needs, right? So we see law enforcement agencies across the country right now, including right here in the region, that are employing social workers to help them respond to certain emergency calls. And I remember reading an article just last summer that shared that public libraries in Boston are hiring social workers to assist patrons that have a variety of unmet needs, including food and housing insecurity, mental health challenges, and just a wide range of social problems. And again, parking on the increased need for more social workers, can you share more about what you see as social workers play a critical role in, I guess, bridging the gaps, providing essential services that help support community members thrive socially and emotionally?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you mentioned the police department. In fact, the LaPorte Police Department has a social worker, and the social worker who is placed there is a student of our Bachelor's of Social Work program.
Oh, wow.
That has been around for quite some time now. And we just got reaffirmed with our accrediting body, which is Council on Social Work Education, for the next 8 years. And we're very proud of that placement. So this student actually works with the police, and I think she's one of the first to be placed in this region, you know, as a police social worker. And so they do all kinds of things. They not just work with the community and, you know, respond to crisis calls and go out with the officers, you know, trying to de-escalate a very stressful situation. They also work, especially in the police department, work on the mental health needs of the police. We also have a faculty member in our program who has just started doing a little bit of work with the police addressing their mental health needs. So it's kind of a twofold role. So one is the connection with the community and meeting the needs in the community, but also trying to address the mental health needs of these police officers who work in such stressful situations, in such stressful jobs. And so that's one place where, that's one of the many places where we need social workers. I'm also glad you mentioned libraries, because that is another place where social workers are needed, especially with a large number of, you know, homeless people who show up at the library, people who are looking for jobs who show up at the library. And so connecting them with resources, helping them, you know, find jobs, helping them find housing, to taking it to the next level, I think all of those, there's absolutely a huge need for social workers in these settings.
And I'm glad that you shared how the social workers that will be working with law enforcement, as law enforcement agencies continue to bring on social workers, I'm glad you pointed out the importance of social workers not only helping to meet the need, responding to calls, but also helping first responders as well. I remember attending an event hosted by the MAC Foundation, and it was all about the mental health of first responders. That's why we're so excited to have you here today, to just share the importance of why communities need social workers, this increased need for social workers. Before I let you go, the MSW graduates earn qualifications to begin careers in sectors, as we've shared throughout our conversation, as mental health, government, hospitals, schools, addiction centers, and advocacy centers. The program will prepare students for impactful careers. And I want to point out, I don't want our listening audience to miss something you said earlier in the conversation as well, is that PNW has worked hard to make sure that the program is affordable. So if anyone is listening and would like more information about the program, including how to apply, where can they find that information?
Yes, so the website to apply is pnw.edu/msw. We are very thankful to the College of Humanities, Education, and Social Sciences here at PNW to offer a limited number of graduate assistantships to students. And so it is kind of the assistantships will be offered on a first-come-first basis. And so if there is any inclination for you to work in the community, work in hospitals or other settings that we talked about, you should definitely look at social work as an option. I would also like to add another piece that social work is a license-eligible profession. So when you graduate from our program, you will be eligible to apply to be a licensed social worker. And after your graduation, you can work under the clinical supervision of a licensed clinical social worker and get your LCSW, which basically means that you don't need supervision anymore. In other words, you can work independently, have your own private practice, and so on and so forth. So that is another important piece about the profession of social work, that we are license eligible and we do a lot of mental health work, you know, in a variety of settings.
Dr. Bhandari, I thank you so much for joining us today on Regionally Speaking, sharing information, obviously, about all of the graduate programs that are available at PNW, who has been working so hard to improve those programs, but specifically joining us today to share information about the program you represent as the director of the Master of Social Work. So I thank you for joining us, and we look forward to you guys getting a flood of applicants to become the next great social workers serving the community in the region.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Sharia Bhandari is the director of the Master of Social Work program, as well as a professor of social work at Purdue University Northwest. For more information, visit www.pnw.edu/programfinder/masterdegreeinsocialwork. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media.
Mommy's Haven is a maternity home with a mission to empower and equip moms and pregnant women seeking parenting options by providing physical, emotional, and spiritual support during and after pregnancy. Katie Camus is the executive director of Mommy's Haven, located in Lowell, and she joins us now to discuss the housing as well as other programs offered to moms in need in Northwest Indiana. Katie, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Katie, so since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, there has been a nationwide expansion of pro-life maternity homes. And that's why we have you with us today on Regionally Speaking. So I want to start with this. What is Mommy's Haven? And to the point, what is a maternity home?
So a maternity home is it can look very different depending on what organization, but typically they cater to providing some sort of housing and sometimes programming for women while they are pregnant, so that they can learn skills and kind of get back on their feet while they are pregnant. Mommy's Haven does a lot more than that. We are one of the longest-term programs in the country. And we've also expanded our services pretty greatly over the past few years. So we do offer housing in two different ways. So one is kind of a group living situation. We are set up as a house, so we are not It is not a shelter environment. And so women, if they're pregnant or if they have infants, can come and live in our building where we have support staff 24 hours a day. We do case management. There is a ton of programming that the women who are in Mommy's Haven go through, everything from prenatal and self-care to parenting classes, healthy relationships, finances. They learn how to change their oil and check their tires.
Wow.
Pretty much any life skill that somebody could need to run a household, they will learn while they are with us. They also are employed and seeking out opportunities. Our program right now is anywhere from 12 to 24 months. So depending on if the mom is pregnant, where she's at in her pregnancy, or if she is postpartum, will kind of depend, as well as how quickly she's meeting her goals and getting through the programming.
Go a little further into unpacking some of the actual programs that you offer through Mommy's Haven.
Sure. So our programs are, while some are kind of all-encompassing for anyone who comes in, there are others that are tailored to where women are in their journey. So if we have, especially first-time moms, we make sure that we go through all of the what to expect when you're pregnant and postpartum. We go through how to care for yourself, how to care for a newborn. There are programs on healthy relationships, whether that is romantic or family, as well as friends. We go through financial responsibility. So we work on budgeting, how to, if that woman is on state benefits, how to make that work for her family, how to make that stretch throughout the month, and how to make healthy choices. They learn how to cook, how to do laundry, how to clean, when to go to the doctor, when to take their children to the doctor. They also have we have a great mentor program. So each of our residents is paired up with a mentor based on a few different surveys that each of the people involved take, so that we can match them up with the right person. And that is kind of their go-to person throughout the program. So they are volunteers. They work on tracking goals. They work on a whole separate set of programming that they do, but that's kind of like they're the one person involved in the program that is only there for them. And so a lot of times what we want is that relationship to build. So even after the women kind of graduate the program, a lot of times that mentor stays in their life. They're the person coming to the kids' birthday parties and celebrating holidays with them. And so that is a really great piece that we're really proud of, because it makes a huge difference in these women's lives. And then we have other programs like case management, and we have substance abuse treatment. We do group and individual therapy, just all sorts of any aspect of their life. We have a program that's going to help them learn those skills.
Katie, in addition to all of the programs Mommy's Haven offers, there are a number of volunteer opportunities, and as you just mentioned, the volunteer mentors is one of them. But I want you to talk more about other volunteer opportunities that pregnant women and their families receive, including transportation and babysitting, just to name a few.
So transportation's a big one that we're always in need of. While the goal of each woman when they're in the program, their first financial goal, if they don't have transportation, is to obtain it. So whether that looks like having to get a driver's license or just purchasing a car. So in the meantime, we provide transportation for all of our residents, whether it's for work or daycare or medical appointments, things like that. And so we're always looking for help because, you know, when we have multiple women in the house, it can get kind of tricky coordinating schedules. So that's a big one. We do offer babysitting in some aspects. So we do require that our residents get daycare for their children and are working a job that can fit inside of those daycare hours. But in the meantime, while they're waiting for daycare assistance or if they are going to outside substance use treatment, like maybe an AA meeting or Celebrate Recovery, or they are working on mental health things. So if they're seeing their therapist, we will provide babysitting for those things, as well as like job interviews and that whole process up until they are working. So we're always looking for volunteers for that as well, especially if mom has some things she needs to do in relation to her health or well-being or employment when the baby is too young to be in daycare. And, you know, we've experienced over the last several years instances, especially during COVID or during really heavy, like cold and flu seasons, where daycares are having to close for a day or two or three at a time. And, you know, mom still has to go to work. And so we try and find volunteers for that as well. That's really the bulk of our volunteering. We have a big new project, a new building that we just bought. So there is many opportunities for people who have skilled trades knowledge, you know, or who want to donate certain things. That list is usually up to date on our website. But I always say, if you have a talent or a hobby that you would love to share, you know, sometimes the volunteering may look like I'm going to come and cook, or we've had people come and like bring fruits and vegetables that they have grown and the women in our program have learned how to can and, you know, bake certain things. So if there's something that somebody loves to do and they'd love to share it, our moms really like opportunities to learn new things and to have new experiences. So that is always welcome as well.
So you just mentioned something that I want to be sure that we highlight with our listening audience today. So you mentioned that you guys have just taken on a new project and that you are expanding to transitional housing. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, so previously, everything we did in our program was done in one building. If the woman needed the residential part, we do offer just programming. If somebody has a safe place to live, you know, they can just do the programming side. But our program is set up like a step down. So at first, there are a lot of rules, there are a lot of boundaries. You know, it's not just really like a come and go as you please sort of setting. And as the woman in the program gets through her programming and is hitting goals, some of those things loosen up. And the last part of our programming is the transitional piece. So that is the part where, like, they've done all of the work, they're making great progress, they don't need so much structure. They still need that safety net of the program. They still need some things to support their mental health and their sobriety and parenting in those early days, because all of those are big stressors and things that take a little bit longer to kind of get ironed out. So that used to all be done under one roof. And we've recently purchased a second building that will be just the transitional portion. So once they reach that mark where they're like, okay, I've paid off all my debts, I'm able to save some money, I have steady employment, and everything is, you know, pretty smooth, they move into this transitional portion of the program where they pay a very, very low subsidized rent. And instead of a group living situation, they are individual apartments. And they still get things like casework. They still have their mentor. They still have access to all of the group and individual therapy, and as well as being able to utilize things we have in donations. So, you know, during the program as a whole, they're earning points for doing all of the things that they're supposed to do. And that's how they purchase their diapers and wipes and toiletries and gift cards for whatever they are wanting to buy outside of that. And they can still utilize that in the transitional part. So, you know, they're going to work, they're raising their babies, but instead of having to try and find an apartment that is safe and near their work and daycare that they can afford, they can stay in our second transitional part of the program where the rent is going to absolutely be something that they can afford. They're just down the street from, you know, the original program. So they're still tied into the community, close to work and daycare, and kind of that last stepping stone towards being able to be out on their own completely. So they, you know, can have a whole extra year of being able to save money and make good financial choices and, you know, get raises or get promotions at work or find a better paying, more stable job before they're out on their own.
Now, Katie, one thing that I noted in preparation for our conversation today, I took a look at your social media page, and I noted that you guys, Mommy's Haven, shares the needs of mothers as well as a request for assistance for mothers. And I think that is so awesome. So tell us, how has the community responded to those requests that you post on your Facebook page?
Yeah, we are never wanting, and it is, the community has really blown us away with their support. You know, we have a lot of instances where mom is going back to school or starting a new job, and there's something very specific they need, like maybe non-slip shoes or scrubs and things like that. And there has not been a single time that we have posted a need for a mom that it has not been filled immediately. We could not do what we do without the community support that we get on a consistent basis. And, you know, those things are so important. And our moms being able to go out into, you know, to further their education or to go out into the working world and feel confident and cared for goes a long way in them having the ability to be successful at what they're doing.
Katie, before I let you go, if anyone would like more information about your organization, Mommy's Haven, including volunteer opportunities, I might add, where can they go?
So our website is mommieshaven.org, and all of our information is on there. There is a Get Help tab for anybody that is looking at our program to get assistance, whether that's residential, programming, or both. And there is also a volunteer tab on there. So there are certain specific volunteer opportunities you can choose, but then there's kind of a general one that's just like, here's my idea, here's what I'd love to do, and you can also put that in there, and we are always open to those types of things. You can donate directly on our website, but we are on Instagram and Facebook as well. That is usually the place to go to see like the most updated needs list that we have and all of our, you know, exciting fundraisers or opportunities that may not be something that's always present, but, you know, is kind of an immediate need for volunteers.
Katie Camus is the executive director for Mommy's Haven Maternity Home. Katie, thank you so much for spending time with us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guest, and we'll be back with you next week with an all-new show.